Today is Thursday, May 20th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, pressure mounts for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
Both Secretary Blinken and the president himself are engaged in robust diplomacy that is behind the scenes.
Plus, bipartisan capital pro-bill faces uncertain future in the U.S. Senate.
GOP Chief Mitch McConnell hurt the bill's prospects by saying he's against it, noting the Justice Department and congressional panels are already looking into the riot.
Also, Nigeria arrests dozens in insurgency crackdown. Our top story today is in the Middle East. Israel carried out over a dozen airstrikes in Gaza after midnight Thursday, targeting what he said was a weapons storage unit in the Gaza City home of a Hamas official and military infrastructure in the homes of other commanders from the group. Rocket sirens blared just after midnight in the southern Israeli town of Be'er Sheva and in areas bordering Gaza, with no reports of casualties or damage. A senior Hamas official predicted a ceasefire within days in the Israeli-Gaza conflict after U.S. President Joe Biden urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to seek a, quote, de-escalation, unquote, in the fighting. World Health Organization officials on Thursday called for a humanitarian pause in Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip to allow access for aid. They are warning the territory faces critical shortages of healthcare supplies and have appealed for $7 million in urgent funding for Gaza and the West Bank. One fear is a surge in COVID-19 infections as families crowded into bomb shelters. In addition, the main Ministry of Health laboratory handling COVID-19 tests has been bombed. That's Rami Abdallah, a Gaza Health Ministry official, saying they expect an increase and spread of the virus. He says the shelters cannot meet basic public health needs, such as personal hygiene, spacing, or wearing masks. Also today, the UN General Assembly will convene an urgent session requested by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the group of Arab countries at the United Nations to deliberate on the fighting between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip. U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who has called for an immediate halt to the hostilities, will address the special session. As the Israeli-Palestinian conflict showed no sign of abating, Democrats in the U.S. Congress called for a ceasefire, while Republican lawmakers condemned the actions of Hamas, saying there was no moral equivalence between the two sides. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Jefferson has more.
Continuing violence between Israel and Palestinians, drawing protesters outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., where the conflict has split U.S. lawmakers since hostilities began 10 days ago. Hamas has been firing rockets into Israel in response to what militants say are Israeli human rights abuses against Palestinians, while Israel has responded with airstrikes on Gaza.
The Israelis were wrong to pursue settlements and evictions as a deliberate means to undermine a future Palestinian state. These policies might have helped hold together Netanyahu's political coalition, but they helped feed a sense of hopelessness amongst Palestinians and their future. The Palestinian leadership was wrong to perpetuate an anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic narrative as a foundation of their hold on power.
Progressive Democrats, including Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are calling for a reevaluation of U.S. aid to Israel because of the civilian casualties caused by the Israeli airstrikes. But most moderates have called for a ceasefire.
Both Secretary Blinken and the president himself are engaged in robust diplomacy that is behind the scenes, that is directly with the Israeli government, that is directly with Egypt and a series of other partners in the region to bring an end to the conflict.
Israeli strikes have killed at least 217 Palestinians, while militant rocket attacks have left at least 12 Israelis dead. Republicans say the two sides are not equally responsible.
There are a significant number of Democrats now who want to throw Israel under the bus and act like there's some equivalency here. There isn't. Completely without moral equivalency. A terrorist group on the one hand that exploits, by the way, the Palestinians themselves by frequently putting them in harm's way, and the Israelis who are going out of their way to make precision responses to defend their country.
Senate Republicans called for further action to protect Israel while denouncing the Biden administration's move to rejoin
the
Iran nuclear deal.
When the Biden administration ought to step forward and say we're going to replenish the Iron Dome munitions that are saving thousands of lives by intercepting these terrorist rocket attacks, instead of attacking and belittling and undermining the nation of Israel.
In time, the Biden administration faces a largely symbolic challenge from progressive Democrats who want to block a $735 million arms sale to Israel. The window to complete that deal has almost closed. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The eruption of violence in Israel and Gaza prompted demonstrations around the world in recent days, with many condemning Israel's airstrikes, while others protested in support of Israel's right to defend itself from Hamas rockets. Even within Israel, Jewish and Arab citizens have taken to the streets and intercommunal clashes that have erupted. The Israeli government last week declared a state of emergency in several cities, calling up extra security forces to contain the unrest. Dana Bell, a former deputy head of the Israeli diplomatic mission in Washington, discussed the domestic unrest in Israel with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi.
I think it's a very disturbing situation in Israel, something that we've not seen the likes of in recent memory, for sure in decades. Definitely people feeling unsafe, walking in the streets, innocent people being targeted just for being Arab or for being Jewish. Magnitude, the scale and magnitude, which we have not seen before. And obviously tensions are boiling. Today, that was a strike by the leaders of the Arab sector. Arabs did not go to work, did not open businesses, a general strike. Something that scenes that remind us of previous decades of Arab protests and Arab dissatisfaction. And this is obviously happening as there's a political stalemate in the country with no elected government in the last 2 years and probably heading to a fifth elections very soon. And so this political instability, the fact that the situation in Gaza is escalating, the fact that Hamas has very sophisticatedly managed to take the role of the defenders of Al-Quds, the defenders of Jerusalem, and initiate this fight for the defense of Jerusalem has galvanized many in the Arab population of Israel, leading to what we see now. So Hamas has been not only shown great capabilities militarily, that unlike what we've seen before, but it has also managed to impact the street, the Israeli street, leading to this Arab-Jewish violence. It will require great steps by the Israeli leadership, by the leaders of both communities, Jewish and Arab. It will require dialogue, because what has happened in recent weeks has set the clock back seven decades.
So do you think that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu does bear any responsibility for inflaming emotions between Arabs and Jewish citizens of the state of Israel?
Well, he particularly personally has not lighted up the match which set up the fire here. He certainly has political allies who have done so and have been an inspiration to those rioters, to those who are, you know, beating or killing Arabs in the streets. Yeah, so maybe indirectly, for sure he has a responsibility here, and he needs, along other Israeli leaders, to, you know, get things back in order, require a major process of reconciliation.
That was Dana Bell, a former deputy head of the Israeli embassy in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov both stressed their two countries have differences but should work together on some issues as they begin talks in Iceland on Wednesday night. The meeting marked the first high-level in-person talks between the Biden administration and the Russian counterpart ahead of a possible presidential summit in June in an attempt to improve the dire relations between the former Cold War foes.
As President Biden shared with President Putin, we seek a predictable, stable relationship with Russia. We think that's good for people, good for the Russian people, and indeed good for the world. And we find ourselves here today, actually, for the Arctic Council meetings, where Russia and the United States have cooperated well in the past, and we look forward and hope certainly to do that going forward, especially as you assume the chairmanship of the Council. It's also no secret that we have our differences, and when it comes to those differences, as President Biden has also shared with President Putin, if Russia acts aggressively against us, our partners, our allies, we'll respond. And President Biden has demonstrated that in both word and deed, not for purposes of escalation, not to seek conflict, but to defend our interests. But having said that, there are many areas where our interests intersect and overlap, and we believe that we can work together and indeed build on those interests.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The United States announced this week that it will share an additional 20 million coronavirus vaccine doses with other countries, in addition to the 60 million it has already committed. Where are the vaccines going? That remains a question unanswered, as VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
There are two things that the State Department Coordinator for Global COVID Response made clear Wednesday about the 80 million vaccine doses the U.S. government is dispatching around the globe. One, they haven't decided who gets what, which is a fact that Gail Smith stressed in a rapid-fire teleconference in which journalists from the Caribbean, India, Brazil, Africa, East Asia, and the European Union asked that same question repeatedly and with varying degrees of urgency, as many nations stare down yet another wave of the deadly virus. Smith emphasized the U.S. is working closely with the global COVAX facility to determine where the vaccines are needed most and how they can be most equitably distributed.
We have not made the decisions on allocations yet. We'll have that information for you sometime in the near term. What we are doing is looking at every region in the world, and we are well aware of the extremely low vaccine coverage on the African continent.
The other point Smith emphasized, despite the fact that the U.S.'s top adversaries, China and Russia, are ramping up their own vaccine donations around the world, this move by the U.S. is not a case of vaccine diplomacy. Smith stressed repeatedly that the U.S. will distribute according to need and not to curry favor.
Our view with respect to vaccine diplomacy, and I think a really important point here, is that vaccines are tools for public health. They are the means for bringing this pandemic to an end. We do not see them and do not intend to use them as means for influence or pressure. And our decisions will be made on the basis of need, public health data, and again, collaboration with key partners, absolutely, including COVAX.
However, Smith did note that the U.S. is the biggest donor of vaccines to the COVAX facility and urged other wealthy nations to step up. She also noted that this vaccine donation will be accompanied by investments in vaccine manufacturing sites around the world and U.S. assistance to improve other countries' access to therapeutics and testing. What this is, to put it simply, as President Joe Biden did this week, is a case of that old kindergarten adage, sharing is caring.
There's a lot of talk about Russia and China influencing the world with vaccines. We want to lead the world with our values, with this demonstration of our innovation and ingenuity and the fundamental decency of the American people. Just as in World War II, America was the arsenal of democracy in the battle against COVID-19 pandemic, our nation is going to be the arsenal of vaccines for the rest of the world. We'll share these vaccines in the service of ending the pandemic everywhere. And we will not use our vaccines to secure favors from other countries. We'll work with COVAX, the international organization set up, and other partners to ensure that the vaccines are delivered in a way that is equitable and that follows the science and the public health data.
So the White House says this is not a race for global domination. This is, however, a race for global immunity, a race in which, unusually and wonderfully, everyone wins. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Spanish authorities carried out mass expulsions of migrants on Wednesday from its North African enclave of Ceuta after thousands crossed from Morocco as the tide of humanity swimming around the border fence turned into a trickle. Olivia Chan of Reuters reports.
17-year-old Moroccan migrant Adam is one of the over 8,000 migrants who entered Spain's North African enclave Ceuta from Morocco earlier this week, just before Spanish authorities carried out mass expulsions of migrants.
Actually, I am here in Ceuta, and I'm here for survive and for help my family. So my country don't have any justice. The Morocco is big bad country.
On Wednesday morning, Spanish soldiers in combat gear and police officers were seen escorting some swimmers directly back to Morocco, while Moroccan police drove hundreds of young men away from the border fence. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said as many as 4,800 who entered Ceuta had been sent away.
Let's remember, the border with Ceuta is not only the border between Morocco and Spain, but it's also a European border. Consequently, the lack of control, in this case by the Moroccan authorities, isn't only a lack of respect towards Spain, but towards the European Union as a whole.
The Spanish enclave's leader had accused Moroccan authorities of failing to police their side of the border actively and linked that to a decision by Madrid to admit Brahim Ghali, the rebel leader of the Polisario Front, in a Spanish hospital. The Polisario Front wants the Western Sahara to be an independent state rather than part of Morocco. Sanchez did not make this connection. But Morocco's Minister of State for Human Rights, El Mustafa Ramid, suggested that his country has the right to relax border controls, as Spain is hosting, quote, the head of a group that took up arms against the kingdom. A diplomatic source who declined to be named said Rabat recalled its ambassador to Madrid for consultations, adding that relations with Spain needed a moment of, quote, contemplation.
That's Olivia Chan of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. China says it is providing COVID-19 vaccines to nearly 40 African countries and described its actions as purely altruistic. Foreign Ministry official Wen Peng compared China's outreach to the action of, quote, some countries, unquote, waiting to finish vaccinating their own people in an apparent dig at the United States. The U.S. so far has committed to sharing 80 million of its doses with the world. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Nigeria authorities have arrested over 400 suspects they say are sponsors and collaborators of militant groups responsible for worsening security countrywide. Officials say the arrests, part of the government's renewed crackdown on insurgency, are designed to disrupt the financial and logistical network of armed groups responsible for killings of security personnel and abductions for ransom. Critics say the government is attempting to cover up its failure to address growing security threats by arresting innocent citizens. For more, I spoke with security analyst Abubakar Mohammed.
I've gone through the list because it's there in the open domain. I've honestly not seen, you know, any name that rings a bell. They're all businessmen, and some of them are owners of Bureau de Change. They have to move money. I believe there are still others. These 400 are not people that are the main financiers, the main coordinators of the movement. The government should do more. And just like it was said during the regime of former President Jonathan, some of them are even in government.
Critics of the government are saying if the government is really serious, it should arrest and prosecute the main sponsors and big men and influential politicians, not just Bureau de Change operators who might just be doing legitimate business.
I agree with that. To make an arrest and make an example of one big shot, someone that could be used as a public example for all, it will serve as a good deterrence. But these very people, these 400 people, if their arrest is really, really something very tangible, how come the attacks have not stopped? If these people that were arrested and are about to be prosecuted, if they are the real players, the real coordinators, how comes, even though they have been arrested, they are about to be prosecuted, the offensive attack from both ISWAP and JAS has not declined. It has not stopped. There are still others that need to be apprehended.
The main opposition People's Democratic Party are accusing the government of just trying to deflect criticism, that these people are actually not terrorists, but the government just wants to posture to not just the international community, but to Nigerians that it's actually doing something.
No, I disagree with that because personally I've visited 7 people of the Nigerian army in Maiduguri, and I've seen some of those very people. I've interacted with their relatives. These are people that help in moving finance for this terrorist. But just like I've said earlier on, more arrests needs to be done. You understand? These are more or less errand boys of the real people. And some of them would never disclose, you know, the identity of the main shakers and movers of the thing. And for PDP, I think they should stop playing politics with this whole thing. It's more than politics. They shouldn't be using it to score cheap political points. In any case, this thing started under their watch.
With these arrests, Has anything changed for the ordinary people in these communities and in these locations?
Honestly, nothing will change. The only thing that can make things to change for the people in the community is if the Buhari government can hold the state governors responsible so that we could see some semblance of governance in the local government. At the moment, there are still so many ungoverned spaces. There is no any visible presence of government in the local government. You go to places, you don't see any semblance of authority there. So those spaces that are so many, the criminal element need to step in and take over and exercise their authority.
People are voluntarily joining these terrorist outfits and paying allegiance and even taxes to some of these groups. Is this true?
Some of the people, the locals, some of them are not honest, they are not sincere, and they are seeing it as if this is an Islamic thing or ethnic people are involved in it. It all boils down to the lack of patriotism, that's number one, because so many people still don't even have the strong faith in Nigeria as a country.
That's security analyst Abubakar Mohammed speaking with me from Maiduguri. The UN Refugee Agency is reiterating its appeal to Tanzania to stop forcibly deporting asylum seekers fleeing violence in Mozambique's volatile Cabo Delgado province. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Reports say Tanzania has turned back more than 4,000 Mozambican asylum seekers since September. The UN Refugee Agency says this includes more than 1,500 people who have been forcibly returned in the last month. They currently are sheltering in dire conditions in the Negomano border point in Mozambique. The UNHCR participated in an interagency mission to this remote, hard-to-reach area in April. Agency spokesman Boris Cheshikov says the deportees told mission members they had hoped to find refuge in Tanzania after fleeing deadly attacks by armed groups in the town of Palma in March. However, they said they were forcibly returned by authorities after trekking for days in difficult terrain and crossing a river by boat to reach Tanzania. Cheshikov says many women and young children were among them. He adds a number of families became separated while fleeing their villages or upon arrival in Tanzania.
Many reported being detained, transported to a local school, and interrogated by Tanzanian officials. Those unable to provide evidence of Tanzanian nationality were returned to Mozambique through a different border point from the one used to enter the country, including individuals of or families of mixed nationalities.
Cheshikov says the situation is particularly desperate for single mothers living in Negomano without family support. He says people are in dire need of food, water and sanitation and health care, but providing humanitarian aid is hampered by difficulties in accessing this remote area.
We have appealed to the government of Tanzania for cooperation to enable us to have access to the border areas, and we're standing ready to support the government to receive the refugees in line with their international obligations. What we're doing is reiterating our call for all parties to allow free movement of civilians fleeing violence and conflict and searching for safety and assistance.
About 724,000 people have been forcibly displaced since the start of the conflict in northern Mozambique's gas-rich Cabo Delgado province in October 2017. Aid agencies have been providing protection and basic relief to 50,000 people. The UNHCR says plans are underway to assist an additional 250,000 people by the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New Zealand plans to rebuild its Arctic base and spend billions more on welfare payments and infrastructure to lift its economy out of a coronavirus slump. Those plans are in the government's next budget revealed Thursday. They indicate the economy is doing much better than the forecast after the pandemic hit. That's thanks in large part to the nation's success in stopping the spread of the virus, as well as strong international demand for milk and other agricultural exports. Treasury figures indicate the nation's economy is expected to grow by 2.9% this year and rise to a robust 4.4% growth in 2023. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu from Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.